listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. The Curious Case of the Cardboard Basquiats. A show of lost works by the celebrated artist Jean-Michel Basquiat at the Orlando Museum of Art was meant to be a blockbuster. Then the feds came knocking, by Nate Freeman. The source: more than three decades after his death, Jean-Michel Basquiat's posthumous cultural dominance has made his work a favorite of forgers. Opening photo shows Basquiat in 1984, photographed by Brad Branson. Next photo, art handlers. The Orlando Museum of Art's Basquiat exhibit drew outsized crowds until the FBI's art crime team seized the 25 works that made it up. On a Friday in June 2022, a swarm of federal agents piled out of government vans and into the Orlando Museum of Art, a 98-year-old institution abutted by several lakes. The feds moved past staffers and crowds there to see Heroes and Monsters, an exhibition filled with what were billed as never-before-seen works by Jean-Michel Basquiat. When the show had opened several months earlier, thousands came through in its first few days. Attendance was up 500% during the exhibition. But questions about the authenticity of the works had dogged the show, and now the feds had arrived, warrant in hand, seemingly confirming the doubters. The day before the raid, a U.S. magistrate judge had signed an application to secure a search warrant filed by the FBI's art crime team that indicated the works on the wall could actually be contraband, fruits of crime, or other items illegally possessed, as the application put it. The agents proceeded to strip the walls, while visitors there to peruse and spend money at the gift shop, stocked with Basquiat-themed merch, looked on. By that evening, it was national news. All the while, Aaron DeGroft, the director of the museum, was in Italy on vacation with his wife. He was fired 4 days later. "They simply cut off my email," he told me this spring in his first extensive interview since his dismissal. Still, it wasn't a complete shock. The FBI had been investigating the so-called Basquiats for almost a decade, and the Bureau issued a subpoena to the museum in July 2021. In February 2022, the month the show opened, Orlando Weekly reported that the FBI had seized computers in the weeks leading up to the exhibition's debut, and the New York Times ran a story that delved into the painting's mysterious provenance. The affidavit said that the FBI might possess enough evidence to charge individuals with conspiracy and wire fraud, evidence that showed the work's owners may have been attempting to sell forged art, which would be a felony. The timing of the June raid was apt. The show was set to close in less than a week, and the paintings were to travel to Italy, outside the art unit's jurisdiction. For almost a year after the raid, nothing seemed to happen, and as I began reporting this story, the case was something like an art world unsolved mystery. Were the paintings indeed fake? And if so, how had they wound up making such a splash? The investigation appeared to be stalled or even abandoned. The paintings remained seized. DeGroft remained out of work. The Orlando Museum of Art turned over its walls to the late artist Purvis Young, followed by the exhibition From the Andes to the West Indies, Spanish colonial paintings from the Toma collection. Then, in April, a break. U.S. Attorney Martin Estrada filed notice of a plea deal between the Central District of California and North Hollywood auctioneer Michael Bartzman, a key character in the raid on Basquiat Extended Universe. According to filings made public with the plea, when the FBI interviewed Bartzman 9 days before agents obtained the warrant for their raid last June, he explained he'd sold artworks in the manner of Basquiat to three of the same people. According to the affidavit, who went on to lend them to the show in Orlando, the affidavit refers to people by their initials, but their identities have been confirmed by various reports. The catalog for the show also mentions Bartzman, referring to him as the small-time Los Angeles auctioneer who said he found the paintings in a storage unit that he purchased in Los Angeles. The affidavit also says that Bartzman signed a sworn statement that he had sold works to the clients, who later loaned them to the Orlando Museum of Art, creating a clear, if remarkable, narrative for the work. Next photo, method painting. In his confession, Michael Bartzman, who worked in Basquiat's free jazz style, said he made the works on cardboard quickly, without any practice. In October, with Bartzman's partial confession still under wraps and the mystery lingering publicly, the feds met with him once again, bringing along a work they had seized. Agents explained to their interrogatee that affixed to that same oil stick and acrylic on cardboard artwork, hidden behind thick impasto, purportedly by Basquiat, was a shipping sticker with none other than Mike Bartzman's name and address. Bartzman claimed that he had never seen the work and said that he had no idea how a shipping label bearing his information got on the back of it, reads the plea agreement. 8 days later, Bartzman met with the federal agents again and finally blurted out what some had suspected the entire time. He had made all of the Basquiat's himself, along with a friend identified in the plea as J.F., creating some of the pieces in as little as 5 minutes and sold them over eBay, splitting the profits. Though he sold forged work knowingly, the government declined to charge Bartzman with wire fraud and instead levied the lesser offense of making false statements to a government agency, which carries a maximum sentence of 5 years. For those who had been closely watching the case, the news brought a sense of finality to the proceedings. Months after the raid, the most scandalous episode in recent U.S. art museum memory, someone admitted guilt. The museum issued a statement offering its support for the plea agreement, appearing to leave no room for debate about the fact that a year ago fake Basquiat's were on its walls. The museum is eager for the DOJ to continue its investigation and hold those who committed crimes responsible. When this investigation is closed and charges are brought, the museum looks forward to sharing our story regarding the works in question, a statement from the board chair read. Bartzman has stayed silent since the plea agreement went public, but Vanity Fair has spoken with sources who were intimately familiar with Bartzman around the time he was buying up foreclosed storage units, hoping to find forgotten treasure, and sifted through the various legal documents that contain Bartzman's statements to federal agents. It all amounts to a story of how these paintings, once offered as in the manner of Jean-Michel Basquiat, got into the hands of a group of ambitious owners who managed to get them onto the walls of the Orlando Museum of Art, thanks to a director trying to bring blockbuster audiences to the primary art museum in Florida's theme park capital. If the works are fake, as Bartzman claims, it turns the 168-page museum catalog into an elaborate fantasy on the level of a season of Game of Thrones. Bartzman also broke his silence to Vanity Fair for the first time since his name shot around the world in April, when he admitted to faking the paintings. Bartzman's attorney, Joel Corey, sent this statement on behalf of his client. Over a decade ago, Desperate and deep in medical debt from being treated for bone cancer, I made the wrong and terrible decision to forge these works, reads the statement. Since then, I have tried to do everything I could to rectify my mistake. I am ashamed and sorry for my part in this, and hope I can finally move on. But the former museum director and the owners of the works aren't buying it. Over the course of interviews in the days following the plea deal, as well as several lengthy text message conversations, De Graft, a PhD in art history, maintained to me that the paintings he put in the show were authentic and that the plea deal is a conspiracy. You know why he was not charged with forgery? Because 25 are right and by Basquiat, and provenance on those is right. He did not forge them, De Graft told me in a text message the day after the plea agreement was announced. 2 days later, he elaborated on his thoughts during a phone call. I think this is a totally sweet deal cover-up, said De Graft. This whole Bartzman thing is a huge cover-up. He's a guy that admits to forging paintings and selling them, and he's not indicted for forgery or fraud, but he's indicted by lying to the FBI, because they said, well, you can do 15 to 25, or you can do 5, and we'll knock it down to 18. I think they told him, cop to the whole thing, or we're going to chop you up. Through his lawyer, Bartzman stands by his statement that he forged the works. The idea that an artwork in a museum could be a forgery, that something potentially worth tens or even hundreds of millions could actually be worthless, is an endless source of fascination, not just for art world insiders, but for the general public. People have been knocking off art almost as long as they have been making it. Legend holds that Michelangelo got his start passing off his own work as antiquity. The most famous recent example of an is it real or fake brouhaha was the Leonardo da Vinci that sold at Christie's for more than $450 million in 2017, making it the most expensive artwork of all time. Experts authenticated it, but then the Museo del Prado categorized the work as attributed to Leonardo rather than by Leonardo, suggesting the painting was made by the master's studio. After it was sold, the painting was slated to be displayed, but was subsequently pulled without explanation. But there's a certain zeitgeist nailing specificity to a mysteriously dubious work by Basquiat, who died of a drug overdose in 1988 at age 27, the same Basquiat whom Jeffrey Wright played in the 1996 biopic by Julian Schnabel, the same Basquiat whose work appears in Tiffany ads with Jay-Z and Beyoncé, the same Basquiat whose painting was sold was Yusaku Maezawa, an intergalactic traveling Japanese billionaire, for more than $110 million. Hype beast drool over Brooklyn Nets jerseys that have script inspired by the Park Slope-born Basquiat, and his collaborative work with Andy Warhol inspired a recent Broadway play and an exhibition at the Fondation Louis Vuitton. In May at Christie's, a Basquiat sold for $67 million, well above the already impressive estimate of $45 million, when a bidding war erupted in the room. The scandal at the Orlando Museum of Art exploded during the latest of Basquiat's ongoing pop culture renaissances, a period during which the artist's notoriety has saturated the culture so fully that it just might attract a family otherwise in town to visit the Magic Kingdom. But that very cultural dominance has made Basquiat a favorite of the forgers, and why one might be pressed to prove that a suspicious Basquiat in their possession is the real deal. In 2018, years before the Orlando debacle, the market was so lousy with suspected fakes that art authenticator Richard Polsky felt the need to pen an op-ed for ArtNet News that served as a guide for spotting them. Some telltale signs, gold crowns, obvious signatures, painted on found objects, and a miraculous backstory of why the work has been missing for decades. Even after Bartzman's plea, nearly every person who played a role in bringing this body of work to the Orlando Museum of Art still maintains the works, and their, it should be said, miraculous backstory are real. Speaking in the weeks after the deal, many of those with a stake in the game truly believed they were not just legit Basquiats, but great, weird, and interesting ones. They were willing to further risk their reputations, insisting that these are works made by Basquiat, works that were found in a Los Angeles storage locker. The evidence uncovered by the FBI was already daunting, and then the U.S. attorney shed light on the shipping address sticker, the confession, and Bartzman's assertion that he was asked to sign a sworn statement. According to the plea agreement, Bartzman claims at least one of the owners dangled as much as $15,000 in front of him if he just signed a document saying the work came from the storage unit, although in an earlier interview he said he was offered $5,000. The owners deny such an offer was ever made, taking Bartzman's assertion in stride, as they have every bombshell in the cast thus far. They remain convinced they'll be vindicated. They now say, "I'm a victim." Great, I'm a victim. Pierce O'Donnell, the celebrity attorney who says he owns six of the works that were in the Orlando show, told me, audibly exasperated, the day after Bartzman's plea deal was announced. O'Donnell and other stakeholders I spoke to after the plea shared a common refrain. At least some of these paintings are real Basquiat's. Michael Bartzman is a proven liar. He lied time and time again, O'Donnell went on. Maybe, he said, to lower his sentence. That he faked them all? This is just a wrinkle. This is not the final chapter. I just want my six paintings back. The sources close to Bartzman say the two men never spoke. And now the believers have to prove the work's authenticity before the investigation goes any further. And before we get to the end of most concluded forgery cases, destruction of the contraband. It would be a terrible, catastrophic tragedy if they say, "Well, this guy said they're all forged. We're going to destroy them all," DeGroft said. Before thinking about the potential end of these works, it's useful to go back to their origins, or at least the origins of the show that raised them from a curiosity of the storage locker wars set to national prominence. DeGroft's lofty ambitions for the museum were a key catalyst in the tale of the so-called Basquiats. These days, it's not enough for a museum to simply organize and exhibit a solid group of works by institutional-level artists. The competition for eyeballs and wallets may be a bit starker in Orlando, where Disney reigns, but it's true in every city to some extent. In the last decade or so, museums have had to compete with trendy art-as-spectacle extravaganzas like the Van Gogh Immersive Experience, which reproduces ear-cutting Vincent's works on grand display in geodesic domes. They have to compete with Instagram catnip, like the Museum of Ice Cream and its lowest common denominator ilk. And then museums also have to compete with 1,000 non-art attention suckers that make it increasingly hard to get bodies into the galleries without a white-hot name. Jean-Michel Basquiat is one such rarefied name, and it was apparently enough to convince de Groft to take a leap of faith. Since the raid, he's largely kept his head down about the entire matter. In the months after his dismissal, the Orlando Museum of Art witnessed a hemorrhaging of staff, including trustees and the chief curator. De Groft's replacement as interim director was Luder Whitlock, the director of a local charitable organization. Less than 2 months later, he resigned. The museum removed five trustees through a formerly ignored bylaw that stipulates a term limit they'd exceeded. Then board chair Cynthia Brungbach stepped down after concerns were raised about how she'd handled the scandal. Brungbach initially replied to a request for comment indicating she would read over questions, but never responded. In January, the American Alliance of Museums put the OMA on probation, making it hard, if not impossible, for the museum to borrow or loan art to other member institutions. That doesn't happen very often. Right now, the Orlando Museum of Art is the only one of more than 1,100 accredited institutions listed as under probation on AAM's website. On April 17th, after months without a director, the OMA announced that it had hired Catherine Mattson, an executive with no museum experience, as its interim CEO. DeGroft is still unemployed. He lost what he says was a $200,000 annual salary, and says that he's having trouble finding another job. I got turned down for a job at the National Gallery that I was deemed to be the best qualified for because of, DeGroft told me, trailing off as he got to the obvious. Both OMA and the National Gallery declined to comment on DeGroft for this article. So he wanted to tell his story. We spoke for the first time in early March. I felt obviously damaged. I felt terrible, traumatized. I felt this has really, really hurt my wife and I and my family, and I want my reputation back, he said. And they forget the 15% raise I got, all the staff, and also the maternity leave that several pregnant mothers did not have until I got there. Everybody forgets all that stuff. It's like, oh, Aaron's just a bad guy that ruined the museum. DeGroft had arrived at the Orlando Museum of Art in 2021, brimming with confidence, a serious museum-built brain, and a generous spirit who could raise funds and generate headlines. Orlando Magazine called him a fervent scholar with a showman's flair. If successful, he would make the institution not just the most important art museum in the state, but one that could compete with Orlando's world-famous theme parks. He took big swings. Months after starting the job, he announced that the museum would expand with a space downtown in a new skyscraper designed by Pelly Clark Pelly and DLR Group that would also house downtown Orlando's first five-star hotel, all reportedly offered rent-free by the developers. The museum pulled out of the downtown project before the Basquiat show opened. A native of Smithfield, Virginia, DeGroft holds a master's in art history and museum studies from the University of South Carolina and a PhD from Florida State University. He was a senior curator at the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens in Jacksonville and then the chief curator at the Ringling Museum of Art in Sarasota. In 2005, he was named director of the Muscarel Museum of Art at the College of William and Mary, his alma mater, and immediately set an ambitious exhibition agenda. In 2008, he staged a show of work on loan from the Uffizi Gallery that was dubbed the biggest show in Muscarel's history. Followed that with a Michelangelo drawing show in 2013, and then in 2015, a Leonardo drawing show that broke attendance records, seeing more than 60,000 people walk through the doors of the college museum. Next photo, Exhibit X. The American Alliance of Museums put the Orlando Museum of Art on probation, making it hard, if not impossible, for the museum, pictured here, to borrow or loan out. Throughout his career, DeGroft has displayed a penchant for finding unheralded works for cheap and having them reauthenticated as the real deal. That talent has raised eyebrows, especially after the raid. In the mid-2000s, he took up the cause of a Tennessee lawyer named Thomas Dossett, who had insisted for decades that a painting in his collection was really, truly one of Titian's rare paintings of a duke. After Dossett enlisted DeGroft's help, the then-museum director discovered a date he said had been misread on a letter, leading him to believe that the work was genuine. Madeleine Viljon, former director of the LaSalle University Art Museum in Philadelphia and a Renaissance art scholar, said the work could be real, though she wouldn't be able to authenticate it without seeing it herself. In 2013, the Muscarelle's chief curator at the time, John Spike, saw a work for sale at an auction house in Vienna he thought might actually be an attributed early work by Paul Cézanne, Spike recounted in a 2017 interview. Spike and de Graeft made what de Graeft has described as a covert trip to Vienna to snap up the work, and later a chemistry professor provided what she deemed was further proof it was indeed a Cézanne. In 2016, the museum acquired what it said it believed was a Peter Paul Rubens study for a work that hangs in the Museo del Prado in Madrid. It was included in a show of other paintings that had recently been acquired by Muscarelle, The Art and Science of Connoisseurship, which opened at the museum in 2017. In Orlando, de Graeft said he was trying to do more than mega museum numbers. He was coming for Disney, coming for SeaWorld. One idea was to create buzzworthy exhibitions to compete with the museums that get offered big-ticket exhibitions, the institutions on the blockbuster show circuit. Orlando is the most visited city in the U.S. De Graeft drew on his history of unveiling recently reattributed masterworks to the public, but this time aimed for something more contemporary. About 5 years before de Graeft started at the museum, O'Donnell began making headlines because of a painting he owned, one he vociferously argued was a real Jackson Pollock, waiting to be authenticated, that could be worth more than $100 million. The work piqued de Graeft's interest. "Dear Mr. O'Donnell," de Graeft wrote in a cold email in March 2021, later memorialized in the Basquiat Show's catalog, "would you be willing to speak about the Pollock? We would love to celebrate it and showcase it here in Orlando, where we lead the country in tourism with an excess of 73 million tourists." When the Pollock show was delayed over issues de Graeft said O'Donnell was having with the co-owner of the painting, the collector mentioned he owned an interest in six never-before-seen works by Jean-Michel Basquiat and had access to 19 more from the same original collection. He gave de Graeft the password for a website where he could view the works. Impressed, de Graeft flew to New York to see the paintings. De Graeft agreed to a show, setting the debut for February 2022. But as the affidavit revealed, as early as 2013, the FBI's New York field office and the Los Angeles Police Department had been investigating a case in which a series of individuals who had recently bought a bunch of artworks from Bartzman, identified in the affidavit as Buyer One, were pressuring another man to say that the artworks came from his storage locker. 7 months before the Basquiats were set to debut in Orlando, the FBI came calling. Next photo, the director, Aaron de Graeft, with one of the works said to be by Basquiat. "They sent this subpoena in July 2021, de Graeft confirmed to me, and we were like, well, what are we supposed to do? The FBI go, no, keep doing what you're doing. We just want to see what you knew when you did this show. And then that's when they were asking questions like, how much did the owners pay you? I said, they didn't. They go, well, why would you do a show if they weren't paying you? And I said, look, my job is to increase the understanding of major art exhibitions in our community. The Orlando Museum of Art declined to comment on whether the FBI indeed told them to proceed with the show. When asked about de Graeft's firing, the museum declined to address it directly, and later in a statement said, we have taken and will continue to take actions that realign the institution with its mission. These actions include board governance training, supporting employees impacted by the exhibition, adopting new personnel policies with enhanced whistleblower protections, and working with the American Alliance of Museums to repair the institution's standing. I had been working on a story about DeGroff for a few weeks when the news of Bartzman's confession broke. Part of me thought, well, the jig is up. The court of public opinion would forever think the works were fakes. Perhaps the owners I'd been speaking with, and their partners, would cut their losses and stop taking my phone calls. Instead, they tripled down, producing another sworn statement, they said, confirmed Basquiat's connection with the man behind the storage locker. Even after someone told the FBI, under the penalty of perjury, that he faked the art, the backstory, the connection. They directed me to the hundreds of documents they've provided the FBI. Despite Bartzman's admission that he faked the artworks and signed the statement for money, there are scores of other documents, emails, receipts, locker storage payment history, sworn statements from others about visits and phone calls that they say build a legitimate provenance for the work. It seems exceedingly implausible that the Basquiats really did come from a storage unit if the owner of said storage unit has confessed to the FBI that he forged them. Then again, the forces who say the works are legit have a case file that displays the kind of world building usually reserved for video games or summer blockbusters. In the hundreds of documents, there emerges a twisty story filled with kooks and criminals, artists and alleged forgers, collectors and crooks, more akin to a Coen Brothers script than the art world. There's Michael William Force, described to me as a picker who finds treasures on eBay, who pleaded no contest to drug charges in the 70s under the name William Parks. His business and romantic partner, Taryn Burns, has over the years joined him in discovering purportedly important artworks, incorporating the LLCs that have been involved in various purchases. Lee Mangan, also known as John Leo Mangan III, is an old friend of Force's who has occasionally gone into business with him. In 2014, according to the affidavit, Mangan purchased works that were supposedly by Jackson Pollock from a man named Jovian John Ray, who, incidentally, ended up pleading guilty to forging 60 works that had been attributed to Pollock, and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Mangan, too, has served jail time for trafficking cocaine in 1979 and 1991. He also pleaded guilty and served probation for his role in a pump-and-dump scheme in 1996 and settled with the FTC after a 2007 investigation into a debt relief company he advertised. According to purchase receipts, Mangan and Force bought the so-called Basquiats with the help of a wildlife trafficker, Lumsden Kwan, who was convicted in 2014 for selling rhino horns to an undercover informant for $55,000. Bridging these two narratives was the only seemingly agreed-upon truth in the case, that it started with a storage locker owned by a man who died in 2018. Named Thaddeus Q. Mumford, Jr., a television writer with no clear ties to the contemporary art world. Thad Mumford was, in the 1980s, working on shows such as Roots, The Next Generations, MASH, and The Cosby Show. He went on to serve as a producer on the Cosby spinoff A Different World and the kids' show Blue's Clues. Before that, he had the distinction of being the first black bat boy for the New York Yankees, cementing his lifelong love of baseball. Later, he'd write occasional columns for the New York Times, including an affectionate remembrance of fetching fouls whacked by Mickey Mantle. But by the 2010s, Mumford had fallen on somewhat hard times. His lawyer, Judith Carfial, recalled this spring. He still had a house in Los Angeles, just a few steps from the Beverly Hills sign, she said, but he was on the verge of losing it. He hadn't worked in almost a decade, since getting a story credit on a cartoon called As Told by Ginger. He was also late on payments to a storage facility, where he had for years kept his belongings. According to documents provided to Vanity Fair, In April 2012, the Ortiz brothers' moving and storage company sent a letter to Mumford at his home in Beverly Hills, informing him that he owed $7,088.81 in back payment. Failure to fork over the cash would mean the contents of his storage locker, on which he had made just one $400 payment 2 years earlier, would be auctioned on May 17th. Mumford did not pay, and the contents of the locker were, according to a signed statement and alleged receipt, purchased by Bartzman. At the time, Bartzman was a 34-year-old co-founder of the Shark Tank-approved power strip product called Invisiblog, an extension cord that blends in with hardwood floors, who before that spent time in the music industry managing a blip of an indie band called I'm a Robot. His flirtations with fame also included a 2016 spot on TMZ after he was arrested for pointing a gun at a guy who was smoking a cigarette near Bartzman's L.A. property, for which he was sentenced to 180 days in prison. Bartzman also managed estate auctions through various companies. Through that business, Bartzman was adjacent to pickers, that most American class of entrepreneurs who buy storage lockers or units in arrears, hoping to find treasures amid the detritus. An employee at Mumford's storage facility said the writer owned three units, and they were auctioned off by American Auctioneers, which is a favorite of the picker community. An unnamed source told the FBI that another auctioneer, bargain bin hunter, bought the contents of the locker that contained Mumford's Emmy and then sold it to Bartzman, which Bartzman recalls he likely posted a photo of online. A document resembling a receipt that was purported to be from the initial sale indicates that a Mike B. was the buyer of a storage locker for a total of $1,050. In February 2013, Bartzman appeared to sign a sworn statement in which he stated that he bought the unit and said, "To my knowledge, the contents of the storage locker, lot number 2125, were owned by a Mr. Thaddeus Mumford." And here he misspelled Thaddeus. It was also signed by a notary public and included photographs of what was inside. Mumford's inscribed Emmy, a bat autographed by members of the Yankees, and a whole lot of works on cardboard supposedly made by Basquiat. But this is the document Bartzman first told authorities that he did not recognize, before later admitting he had signed it after he says Force, Mangan, and Burns offered a payoff he says he never actually got. According to sources, it was around the time he purchased the Emmy that Bartzman hatched a plan to make a trove of fake Basquiats and sell them on eBay, connecting them to Mumford's storage locker. Bartzman had been hard up for cash for years and owed way more than he had. Since his childhood in the mid-90s, he'd been undergoing annual surgeries on his leg due to a tumor that was discovered on his knee when he was a 12-year-old, growing up in the prosperous valley town of Sherman Oaks. Each year, he'd spend months in the orthopedic department at UCLA. He lost his health insurance in 2007 and started racking up thousands in medical debt due to his regular appointments. And in 2012, he was denied insurance for the fifth year in a row due to a pre-existing condition. He reached out to a childhood friend who shared his love for art and had better than amateur draftsmanship. The idea was to make a bunch of would-be Basquiats as soon as possible and sell them quickly on eBay, where the market for forged work was thriving and essentially unregulated. Bartzman himself had recently purchased a fake Andy Warhol soup can. At the time, eBay was, for lack of a better term, just the Wild West, one of the sources close to Bartzman says. There was so much counterfeit and just bad stuff. So they made the works on cardboard quickly without any practice, working in the free jazz style that the artist himself would have embraced. The work found a buyer quickly. Email records show that in late 2012, Bartzman allegedly began selling the artwork online, where he specified in the listing they came from Mumford's Locker. According to interviews with the current owners of the works, Force spotted images Bartzman had posted and immediately asked his longtime business partner, Mangan, to act as a backer. Sources close to Bartzman tell a different origin story. According to the Bartzman camp, Kwan, the man later imprisoned for selling rhinoceros horns to an undercover agent, was the first to reach out. Then his colleagues, Force, Burns, and Mangan, quickly came on board. And, according to an emailed bill of sale and other emails provided to Vanity Fair in October 2012, Bartzman sold 13 purported Basquiat works to Kwan, who paid $10,500 for the haul of cardboard, and his business associates, Burns and Force, quickly arranged for the purchase of several more. Although, as an FBI agent noted in the affidavit, fabricated provenance documents typically accompany forged artwork. Kwan has since sold his interest in the collection and did not respond to multiple requests for comment. With the deal settled, Bartzman had to find a way to hand off the works to their new owners. According to a source, after months of negotiations, Bartzman was too intimidated to meet them himself. So his fellow artist agreed to meet Force in Ventura, near where the source says Force was living in Santa Barbara. The alleged accomplice in the forgery tossed the works on cardboard in the back of a Cadillac, drove an hour north on the 101, and sold them out of his trunk. According to sources, the new owners paid cash. But authenticating mysterious artwork is long-haul, narrative-intensive work, and Bartzman and his partner were still on the hook with their buyers. Bartzman admitted to the FBI that he signed a notarized document indicating he found the paintings in Mumford's storage locker among the baseball memorabilia and the statuettes. But according to the plea agreement and the sources close to Bartzman, the owners wanted more cooperation, more proof, more evidence that the works were real Basquiat's. In the years following the sale, the owners kept in touch with Bartzman, asking him to participate in the process of selling the works by corroborating their provenance. Mangan in particular seems to have aggressively pursued Bartzman. The auctioneer told FBI agents that when he told Mangan he could not prove the work's origins, Mangan reacted with anger. "I was not even angry on that phone call," Mangan said in his response to the claim. "I called him back the next day at the burner number that registered on my phone and shared with him that lying to the FBI can get him 5 years in a federal facility." They'd need a more pedigreed authentication than Bartzman could provide in any case. In 2017, the trio of owners reached out to O'Donnell, who had become something of a celebrity in the art authentication community. During his decades as an in-demand L.A. lawyer, O'Donnell built a reputation for defending the little guy against a Tinseltown juggernaut. Forbes once called him the Perry Mason of Hollywood. He defended Art Buchwald when he sued Paramount for stealing the idea for Coming to America, for which Buchwald was awarded $150,000 for his contribution, and backed the novelist and visual artist Barbara Chase Ribaud when she sued Steven Spielberg, nearly holding up the release of Amistad. The two sides eventually settled out of court. Spielberg, impressed, later hired O'Donnell himself. It all came crashing down when O'Donnell was indicted for illegally funneling $26,000 to John Edwards' 2004 presidential campaign. Pleaded guilty to two misdemeanors and did 60 days in a low-security facility near Santa Barbara. O'Donnell rebounded by joining the mega-firm Greenberg Glusker and now treats unauthenticated paintings like court cases he's trying to win. He spent years trying to prove that his alleged Pollock was given by the artist to a now-deceased scientist named John Adams Comstock. O'Donnell was initially unfamiliar with Basquiat, a source told me. He thought that Forrest was talking about some guy named Brisket. But after the owners of the discovered maybe Basquiat's approached O'Donnell, the lawyer did his research and realized that if they were real, they were made by one of the most important artists of the late 20th century. So he agreed to buy six works and act as an advocate for the so-called Venice Collection Group, despite what he later said were his deep doubts at the time. As O'Donnell wrote in the catalog essay for the show, when I told a close friend familiar with my fruitless Pollock labors about taking on the Basquiats as a client, he bluntly chided me for undertaking another frolic and detour. But O'Donnell started racking up some wins. The Basquiat estate was no longer authenticating works. The artist family ceased all such services in 2012, following a 2008 lawsuit. But the handwriting expert James Blanco said that the script was consistent with the artist. Jordana Moore Seghese, currently an art history professor at the University of Maryland, wrote in a report commissioned by the owners that several of the works, in her professional opinion, may be attributed to Jean-Michel Basquiat. Diego Cortez, an old associate of Basquiat's, saw the works in person in New York, and according to the catalog, stated that a lot of people don't appreciate how good Jean-Michel was at drawing. These pieces reflect the strong graphic work with a central iconic figure, which typifies his work from this period. Cortez died in June 2021, before the Orlando show opened. Michael Klein, a dealer who worked with the Soho Gallery owner, Anina Nosai, when she gave Basquiat a studio in the basement and often watched him work, contributed to the museum catalog and told me he brought Al Diaz, Basquiat's old graffiti partner, to see the works in New York. According to Klein, Diaz gave them a thumbs up. "Yeah, they looked real," Klein said. "I mean, I've seen fakes, and when you see a fake, you know it's a fake. I mean, it's very hard to recreate that." When reached on the phone in May, Diaz said, "Of course I've never seen Basquiat doing stuff on shitty cardboard. I never believed it was real." "The owners called me, and I was like, 'I don't want anything to do with your collection,'" he went on. "The way Mangan approached me, he acted like a Texas tycoon. What he's trying to do is set me up to believe that these are really nice people. And I'm a New Yorker. I can't be fooled. I didn't believe that it was real." Mangan denies having such a conversation. Repeating an anecdote that originates with Mangan, DeGroff told me Richard Marshall, the curator who staged the first big posthumous Basquiat show in 1992 at the Whitney, was given a tour too, and upon seeing the works, supposedly said they were some of the most spectacular Basquiats that he'd ever seen. He was going to write a thing, and he died 2 weeks later, DeGroff said. And then there was the poem. Somehow the owners of the paintings also had in their possession a poem, acquired not from the storage locker, but from somewhere else, that Basquiat was said to have written with Mumford to commemorate their friendship. Quite amazingly, the text specifically refers to 25 paintings bringing riches. At the bottom are the initials JMB, once again authenticated by Blanco. So did Basquiat and Mumford know each other? There are no photographs of the two together, but they were at least in Los Angeles, a city then of about 3 million people, at the same time. In the early 1980s, the artist had stayed for a time in Larry Gagosian's house in Venice. Basquiat would use part of the home as a studio to make work for his second solo show at Gagosian's L.A. space, set for the spring of 1983. He was new to Los Angeles, but befriended the gallery staff and fellow artist, and brought out his girlfriend for a week, an aspiring singer who performed under the name Madonna. But there is little in the way of indisputable proof that Basquiat and Mumford met. Taryn Burns claims she received voicemails from Mumford confirming that he knew Basquiat, but she couldn't produce them. A Toronto art dealer named Talon Maltep signed a sworn statement saying she spoke with Mumford over the phone, as did her friend, the documentary filmmaker Ed Salis. Recordings of those conversations do not exist. Force and Mangan claim to have visited Mumford at his home, but they have no photographs of the meetings and no recordings. Mangan was detailed when he discussed Mumford's carpal tunnel braces, but had no items Mumford gave him or pictures he took while he was there. Carfiel, Mumford's lawyer, says she was approached by Force and Mangan to make an in-person introduction. According to the affidavit, Burns and Mangan offered to fund a TV show Mumford would produce once the work sold for $1 million, if he would sign a sworn document. Mumford never agreed, despite his financial woes. Carfiel says she never arranged a meeting. "I don't believe they spoke to him," Carfiel said. "I don't believe for a minute they talked to Thad." Mumford denied ever meeting the artist, signing a document in August 2017 in the presence of Special Agent Elizabeth Rivas that stated, "At no time in the 1980s or at any other time did I meet with Jean-Michel Basquiat, and at no time did I acquire or purchase any paintings by him. Furthermore, at no time did I store any Basquiat painting at Ortiz Brothers Moving and Storage in Los Angeles or anywhere else." The affidavit has other details, including some that call into question the Basquiat expert cosigns that the owners have used to trace a provenance for the artworks. Agents got in touch with the veteran art dealer John Cheam, who has staged a Basquiat exhibition at his gallery, Cheam & Reed, and served on the Basquiat Authentication Committee before it disbanded. According to agents, while trying to convince Carfiel that the works were legit, O'Donnell told her that Cheam was one of two leading Basquiat experts who confirmed their authenticity several years ago when they viewed them in New York. But when the feds interviewed Cheam, he told them he immediately had suspicions about the artwork's authenticity and thought that they were fake. And this is a note to listeners. My apologies, I have been mispronouncing the gallery's name. It is actually Cheam & Reed. Now we'll continue with the article. "When I reached Cheam over email," he said, "they looked fake the minute we saw them, though more accomplished than many. It's quite incredible what people assume a Basquiat looks like." He added that he went with Richard Marshall, the Whitney curator, whom de Graaft said was going to write an essay before he died. "In an email to me," Cheam said, "we both dismissed them. Amazing to me that it has taken this long to round them up." Another scholar mentioned in the catalog was Sagesi, who upon seeing the Basquiats told O'Donnell, according to the catalog, "These are marvelous works in excellent condition that have many of the distinctive elements of Basquiat's best paintings." According to a 2017 document provided to Vanity Fair, Sagesi had accepted a fee of $60,000 from the Basquiat Venice Collection Group. The consortium of O'Donnell, Force, Mangan, and Burns that owned the works to look at what was then 27 pieces, with the contract stating that they would accept her findings regardless of what they were. The document is signed by Sagesi, and it also states that the professor shall grant us a license to use your report in connection to the marketing and sale of the paintings. According to the catalog, she later said, referring to the works that she was allowed to see in person, "It is my professional opinion that these six paintings may be attributed to Jean-Michel Basquiat, based on their comparison to known works, with which these paintings share imagery and icons." But according to the affidavit, Sagesi appeared to have a change of heart. and in February 2022, emailed O'Donnell and DeGroff, furious that her name was being used to promote the show despite the contract. As I stated before, I am in no way authorized to authenticate unknown works by Jean-Michel Basquiat and want no involvement with this show, she wrote. I do not want to be further associated with any promotion of these works for financial gain or otherwise. The next day, DeGroff responded, CCing O'Donnell. You want us to put out there you got $60,000 to write this? Okay then, shut up. You took the money. Stop being holier than thou. You did this, not me or anybody else, he wrote. These are real and legit. You know this. You are threatening the wrong people. Do your academic thing and stay in your limited lane. Sakase did not respond to multiple requests for comment. In a statement released last July, she wrote that when she tried to disassociate herself from the exhibition, DeGroff bullied and insulted her. When asked about this email, DeGroff clarified that he was not involved in paying her, and she was not paid to authenticate. She was paid to write a report, good or bad. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening music by Calexico, and ending music also by Calexico.